Previously on the Baker's Dozen podcast.
Deadpool lived up to every great review it got. Between that and Guardians of the Galaxy, those are about the only two comic movies I've still been able to get through and really enjoy.
Captivating right off the bat. There's a great cast, beautiful setting, simple plot, and it transcends from a classic whodunit crime mystery into a really complex story.
And for the record, I would have signed a contract at 18 for two kegs of beer.
When you notice the stripes, the dirt in your thrives, hope it's right when you die. Old and bony, dawn breaks like a bull through the hall. Never should have called, but my head's to the wall and I'm lonely.
New York Times film critics Manola Davis and A.O. Scott recently released their top 25 movies from the thousands and thousands released over the past 16 plus years, those they deemed destined to be classics of the future. This had to be a complex, daunting, arduous, and nearly impossible task for the two to undertake. I'm going to post a link to their article in the description for this episode so you can check it out. But for today's podcast episode, I'm not here to review or go through their list, rebuke their choices, or even compare it and contrast it to my own feelings. Instead, much like Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald on The Ringer, as well as countless others all over Twitter and social media over the past week plus, I put together my own list of my 25 favorite movies of the 21st century. I suppose I could have called it the 25 best, but honestly, I wanted more of an MVP vote rather than a most outstanding player. That is, I didn't want to take this list and tailor it to this generation, or look at the opinions of others. Instead, I made it a list that was tailored to yours truly.
I drink your milkshake. I drink it up!
My name is River City Clement, and welcome to a special pop-up episode here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. If you haven't heard from us in a while, well, we did check it back in 2 weeks ago, after a six-month absence. And that was our season finale episode for our fourth season. You can hear it just as you're enjoying this episode by subscribing to our show, The Baker's Dozen Podcast, hosted by yours truly, River City Clement. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find us, whether on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or streaming at our Podomatic.com page. Just search Baker's Dozen Podcast, and it's that simple. So without further delay, let's cue the music and unveil, starting with 25 and climbing all the way to number 1, with a few explanations on some key omissions along the way, my 25 favorite movies thus far of the 21st century, right here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast.
I expect you not to rest until you can assure the Emperor that Galen Erso has not compromised this weapon in any way.
So I'm still in command? You'll speak to the Emperor about war.
Be careful not to choke on your aspirations, Director.
First up on my list is number 25, 2016's Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Not a bad idea to start with the most recent movie that I'll have on this top 25. The Rebel Alliance makes a risky move to steal the plans for the Death Star, setting up an epic saga to follow. As much as I was excited that Episode 7 delivered, it wasn't coming close to making this list. Fortunately, Rogue One is the best Star Wars-related material since Empire, and yet I only wish I could somehow even see the darker original cut of the film. But frankly, the last 7 or 8 minutes of this film are enough to merit a spot on this list for me. But the fact that you can make a space epic with the same tones as Saving Private Ryan and the Star Wars universe, it only makes me more excited for the future of this franchise, particularly the new standalone features.
There's a weird thing about search engines. It's like striking oil in a world that hadn't invented internal combustion. Too much raw material. Nobody knew what to do with it. You see, my competitors, they were fixated on sucking it up and monetizing via shopping and social media. They thought that search engines were a map of what people were thinking, but actually they were a map of how people were thinking. Impulse. Response. Fluid. Imperfect. Patterned. Chaotic.
As we start to climb up the list, number 24, 2014's Ex Machina. A young programmer is selected to participate in a groundbreaking experiment in synthetic intelligence by evaluating the human qualities of a breathtaking humanoid AI. Sometimes you ignore critically acclaimed small-budget movies recommended to you, whether it's on your queue on Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, wherever you stream your TV and movies, or word of mouth from friends. Whether you just don't want to invest the time or your attention too much, you back off. And I did this for Ex Machina for a couple of months. But once I finally clicked on it, what follows was one of the most intriguing science fiction mysteries I've seen in years. Honestly, it brought me to similar emotions and reactions that I had the first time I saw Blade Runner, the first time I saw 2001. It was transforming and innovative. Two words that are very important to me when it comes to science fiction. And as for that ending, it ripped my heart out. It shredded it. Much like HBO's Westworld tries to do so, but ultimately falls short of, with a surprisingly similar theme, Ex Machina near perfect movie making on a much smaller budget than you'd ever think.
Oh man, you made friends with them. See, friendship is the booze they feed you. As they want you to get drunk and feeling like you belong.
Well, it was fun.
Because they make you feel cool. And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't.
Right, because we are uncool. Now, while women will always be a problem for guys like us, most of the great art in the world is about that very problem.
Momentum's gaining, and it's number 23, 2000's Almost Famous. A high school boy is given the chance to write a story for Rolling Stone magazine about an up-and-coming rock band as he accompanies them across their concert tour. The year 2000, spoiler alert, is going to be in heavy rotation on this list. It was a huge year for me, as it was the transition from my senior year in high school to my freshman year in college. Although truthfully, I expected Almost Famous to be higher on this list. It ticks all the boxes for me in terms of nostalgic movie-going experiences. It is raw at its core, filled with burgeoning emotions that are wrapped up in a story surrounded by great music, and the eternal theme of trying to understand what love truly means. It's almost a different answer to different people at different stages of their lives. In fact, it's just that. And that's part of the incredible beauty of Almost Famous, coming to terms with love on your own terms. Number 22 is going to surprise a few of you. It's 2008's WALL-E. In the distant future, a small waste-collecting robot inadvertently embarks on a space journey that will ultimately decide the fate of mankind. Spoiler alert, this is the only animated film that will be on this list. Spirited Away was both beautiful and way ahead of its time, but didn't speak to me enough to merit a second viewing. And while I respect all that Pixar has done in the 21st century, I've stepped away from the studio. WALL-E, however, is everything I could have asked for from this innovative studio. It's a modern-day silent film which artfully pushes one theme throughout, companionship and purpose. Whatever that means to you or whatever it meant to WALL-E and Eve, this idea spoke louder through visuals and storytelling, through facial gestures of a robot, in an animated masterpiece, without more than a handful of words needing to be uttered throughout.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey, Farva, what's the name of that restaurant you like with all the goofy shit on the walls and the mozzarella sticks?
You mean shenanigans?
No! Oh.
You're talking about shenanigans, right?
We just hit Blackjack, number 21, 2001, Super Troopers. Five Vermont state troopers, avid pranksters with a knack for screwing up, try to save their jobs and outdo the local police department by solving a crime. I honestly debated this slot for some time, more than any other. Anchorman filled it at first, Step Brothers floated around it, Wedding Crashers was great until they left the island, 40-Year-Old Virgin was great until its closing act, it was just way too long, and Knocked Up, even for its first hour, even merited an idea. But I ultimately sided with this movie, despite trailers that kept me from seeing it on the big screen, because I can quote it time and time again, and again and again. I'm not sure I'll ever get tired of watching this movie, with friends or by myself, and quoting it again and again and again.
When's your birthday?
22nd of February.
What year?
Every year.
Get out.
Hey.
When's your birthday?
8th of May, 1969.
You're 37.
Yeah.
Get out. When's your birthday? Out.
Is there a problem, officer?
Yes, there is, Mr. Porter. It would appear a number of your patrons are underage.
Well, you would have maybe a month or two south of proper, but if they're in here, it stops them getting into trouble out there. Yeah, the way we see it, it's all for the greater good.
The greater good.
We're picking up some serious momentum as we get to number 20, 2007's Hot Fuzz. Exceptional London cop Nicholas Angel is involuntarily transferred to a quaint English village and paired with a witless new partner. While on the beat, Nicholas suspects a sinister conspiracy is afoot with the town's residents. Many will forever ride with Shaun of the Dead, which is fine and good. It's damn entertaining. But 2007's Hot Fuzz is clearly the superior offering from the trio of Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost. Wacky in every zany British comedy insinuation possible, Hot Fuzz blends legitimate, over-the-top action with hilarious comedy. It knows exactly what it is from start to finish and never deviates from the parody. And for its nonstop mocking of the entire genre, it still shows subtle signs of unabashed love for the likes of Bad Boys 2 and Point Break, which only makes it all the more brilliant and a near-perfect watch.
No jokes about my name. Oh, no. You wouldn't do that. You're trying to be nice.
I don't know any jokes about your name.
Huckleberry Hound.
I don't know what that means.
Huckleberry Hound? Are you nuts?
It's been suggested.
Oh, my darling, no, my darling, no, my darling, Clementine. You were lost and gone forever. Dreadful sorry, Clementine. No?
Sorry. It's a pretty name, though. It really is nice. It means merciful, right? Clemency.
Although it hardly fits. I'm a vindictive little bitch, truth be told.
Number 19 is 2004's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. When the relationship turns sour, a couple undergoes a procedure to have each other erased from their memories. But it's only through the process of loss that they discover what they had to begin with. Voices and visions from the likes of Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry on the big screen, it's almost too good to be true. Just like the relationship of Joel and Clementine in the movie. See what I did there? Innovative and unique to the point of near absurdity, it's almost ironic that at least for me and likely only me, it's this random scene with Tom Wilkinson and Kirsten Dunst that shook me most during this transformative film. Eternal Sunshine changes all of your preconceptions about failed and even future relationships. It's a tall task to ask of in this modern age of cinema, tackling what love truly can be, what moving on can be, and what memories can be of love. It's what makes this movie so beautiful and engaging.
Black Pearl is a real ship.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. I've seen it.
You've seen it?
Yes.
You haven't seen it.
Yes, I have.
You've seen a ship with black sails that's crewed by the damned and captained by a man so evil that hell itself spat him back out.
No.
No.
But I have seen a ship with black sails.
Oh. And no ship that's not crewed by the damned and captained by a man so evil that hell itself spat him back out could possibly have black sails, therefore couldn't possibly be any other ship than the Black Pearl. Is that what you're saying?
Number 18 is 2003's Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl. Blacksmith Will Turner teams up with the eccentric pirate captain Jack Sparrow to save his love, the governor's daughter, from Jack's former pirate allies, who are now undead. Many will be surprised to see that nary of the Lord of the Rings installments will be on this list. Meanwhile, a pirates movie is. Look, forget all the sequels, please. And remember what a summer popcorn blockbuster is supposed to do for its audience. This movie had action, comedy, adventure, a grandiose score, and of course, Keira Knightley. Look, I couldn't ask for more. I think if anyone remembers back to their experience when they first saw this movie, big bucket of popcorn, the theater completely invested, Johnny Depp being a good Johnny Depp, this is what watching a movie in the theater during its opening weekend during the summer, a blockbuster, it's what it's supposed to be. It's what a movie-going experience should be.
Solo act?
Yeah, now.
Now? Used to what? Work with a cat? Every time he'd play a C major, he'd puke a hairball?
I used to have a partner.
What happened?
Threw himself off the George Washington Bridge.
Well, I don't blame him. I couldn't take it either, having to play Jimmy Crack Corn every night. Oh, pardon me for saying so. That's pretty stupid, isn't it? George Washington Bridge. You throw yourself off the Brooklyn Bridge, traditionally. George Washington Bridge. Who does that?
Number 17, the only black and white offering from the 21st century on this list. It's 2013's Inside Llewyn Davis. A week in the life of a young singer as he navigates the Greenwich Village folk scene of 1961. The only Coen Brothers offering on this list, gasp I know, is one that tickles my Bob Dylan fancy in all the right places. No Country for Old Men, I totally understand its appeal and high ranking on many of these types of lists. It garners a lot of number ones, but I didn't need to see it a second time, and it was a bit of overkill, I thought. You know, Cormac McCarthy, not my favorite author, gasp I know. But this movie, look, I almost immediately had to watch it a second time, and if it wasn't a holiday, I would have done that. Whether it's the utter brilliance of Oscar Isaac's performance, Greenwich Village, its predominant setting, as it was days away from being forever changed by a guy known as Robert Zimmerman, or maybe it's just that cat. The auteurs that are the Coen brothers, they had me from the jump, with a special nod to an unforgettable ending to this film.
Hear that?
Yes.
Sergeant Donnie Donowitz. You might know him better by his nickname, the Bear Jew. Have you heard, Aldo, the Apache you got heard about the Bear Jew?
I heard of the Bear Jew.
What'd you hear?
Beats German soldiers with a club.
He bashes the brains in with a baseball bat, what he does. And Werner, I'm gonna ask you one last goddamn time. If you still respectfully refuse, I'm calling the Bear Jew over. He's gonna take that big bat of his, and he's gonna beat your ass to death with it. Take your wiener schnitzel licking finger and point out on this map what I want to know.
Sweet 16 on this list, 2009's Inglourious Basterds. In Nazi-occupied France during World War II, a plan to assassinate Nazi leaders by a group of Jewish U.S. soldiers coincides with the theater owner's vengeful plans for the same. As much as I love Django Unchained, it was always going to be Basterds that made this list for me. And while I really wanted it to be higher, I have to admit that time spent away from Christoph Waltz, who arguably had the best single performance from any movie on this list, or any performance of the century, it always leaves you wondering when he's off screen where Colonel Hans Landa is. Despite brilliant performances from Melanie Laurent and Diane Kruger, and an inventive turn from Brad Pitt, and the tales of the Bear Jew, it's Waltz that completely owns every second of the screen time he's given. This is Tarantino's finest work since a little movie you might know called Pulp Fiction.
Come on. What are you, shy? This is your one opportunity to do something that no one has ever done before and that no one will copy again throughout human existence. And if nothing else, you'll be remembered as the one guy who ever did this. This one thing.
How's that?
Oh, I've done that one before.
We're at the midway point with number 15, 2004's Garden State. A quiet, troubled young man returns home for his mother's funeral after being estranged from his family for a decade. This is what makes a favorites list so much more fun than a best of list. I don't necessarily have to spend my time justifying certain choices for everyone. Instead, it's what I look back at most fondly. Fortunately for Garden State, my first of two summer 2004 picks, I could go all day defending this one against anyone. The work behind the camera from Zach Braff for Scrubs fame, specifically the soundtrack and the interesting camera shots, it hooked me instantly into a barely 25-seat movie theater, which felt like me personally watching this at home in my recliner. That's what Garden State does for me. It engulfed me completely when watching it for the first or the 15th time. Riding home on the metro afterwards with friends, I couldn't say much. I just wanted my own thoughts, and I wanted to process everything the film was saying to me, and not just the entire audience. Look, I'm still finding out new things, double digits in. It's a feeling of warmth, individuality, and the lessons we learn, even if those lessons are learned later in life than we might have hoped.
I used to try to forget about you. I used to try to pretend that you didn't exist, but I can't. You're my girl. You're my little girl. And now I'm an old, broken-down piece of meat, and I'm alone. And I deserve to be all alone. I just don't want you to hate me.
Nearing the Baker's Dozen is number 14, The Wrestler, from 2008. A faded professional wrestler must retire, but finds his quest for a new life outside the ring a dispiriting struggle. In case you didn't know, I was an avid wrestling fan from early adolescence to the year before I went to college. Every monthly Sunday night pay-per-view and just about every Monday night were dominated by the medium. So when you give me this type of story, helmed by Darren Aronofsky to boot, it's an easy sell. And what you end up with is a powerful performance, one of the best of the century from Mickey Rourke, who was so successful because he had to be channeling his own life just as much as that of the lead character, Rodney the Ram. And it's a story that, frankly, as battered and bruised as it is, covered such a flawed topic so poignantly.
There's a man in back of this place. He's the one who's doing it. I can see him through the wall. I can see his face. I hope that I never see that face ever outside of a dream.
Just about to pass the midway point, which means we got it. The Baker's Dozen number 13, 2001's Mulholland Drive. After a car wreck on the winding Mulholland Drive renders a woman amnesiac, she and a perky Hollywood hopeful search for clues and answers across Los Angeles in a twisting venture beyond reality and dreams. I had never fallen into the David Lynch rabbit hole until Mulholland Drive, and a late-night viewing in the spring of 2002. How lynching of me, right? Before that, I'd never seen a second of Twin Peaks, Lost Highway, Blue Velvet, or even The Elephant Man. But like countless others, Mulholland Drive confused the hell out of me at seemingly every turn. But it also simultaneously captured my imagination like no film had before it, and perhaps none since. Look, I can't explain 10% of this movie to most people. But when you start talking to somebody who's also seen it, they're in the same position you are. But their 10%, it's dramatically different. And the next person, a different 10% as well. It's a mix of wonder and awe that only David Lynch can offer its audience.
The crickets and the rust beetles scuttled among the nettles of the sage thicket. Vamonos, amigos, he whispered and threw the busted leather flint craw over the loose weave of the saddlecock. And they rode on in the friskulating dusk light.
Eli was an assistant professor of English literature at Brooks College. The recent publication of his second novel had earned him a sudden, unexpected literary celebrity.
Well, everyone knows Custer died at Little Bighorn. What this book presupposes is, maybe he didn't?
Next up isn't the Baker's Dozen, it's the regular old Dirty Dozen, number 12. 2001's The Royal Tenenbaums. An estranged family of former child prodigies reunites with their father, who's just announced he's terminally ill. Morgan Freeman and Liev Schreiber are never bad choices to narrate just about anything, but would have been criminally wrong in just one case. Because the ever-brilliant Alec Baldwin, the narrator, he became the voice that drove this cinematic tour de force. And that's not even talking about the brilliance of its director Wes Anderson with his finest work, the casting, the set design, just the personalized brand of dark, irreverent humor that Anderson seems to deliver on a daily basis. Although Grand Budapest never spoke to me. Look, you can also shove The Life Aquatic boring as it can be, and instead, give me this movie, my favorite dysfunctional family of the 21st century, in a story I could watch over and over.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance. In this life or the next.
Number 11, another one from 2000, Gladiator. When a Roman general is betrayed and his family murdered by an emperor's corrupt son, he comes to Rome as a gladiator to seek revenge. Big budget historical action adventure dramas, they don't seem to work much more. Big budget historical action adventure dramas, they just don't seem to work much more, do they? Thank God this century has Ridley Scott's masterpiece Gladiator, even if it was all the way back in the year 2000. What about Gladiator isn't perfect? Unreal action sequences, a timeless story of murder and revenge, and the rise and fall of an empire through the many victories and defeats of its greatest hero. It's the protagonist you root for and a story you're not going to forget.
Four of us wolves running around the desert together in Las Vegas looking for strippers and cocaine. So tonight, I make a toast.
What? What do you got there?
Oh,
oh,
yeah.
Oh,
oh,
oh.
Fuck God.
Yeah. What are you doing?
Oh.
What is that?
Blood brothers.
God. Don't!
Damn it!
Why did you...
Here.
Alan.
No!
No,
I'm not
Alan.
Doing that!
Go ahead, Stuart.
Make him stop.
Alan.
Our first movie in the top 10 is number 10. It's 2009's The Hangover. Three buddies wake up from a bachelor party in Las Vegas with no memory of the previous night and the missing bachelor. They make their way around the city in order to find their friend before his wedding. I'm always going to ride for crude yet smart humor. I also know, much like The Shawshank Redemption, but for entirely different reasons, that whenever I land on The Hangover on TV, I know what I'm doing for the next hour plus. Look, this movie didn't simply refuse to apologize for what it was. It dove headfirst into humor that didn't pull any punches and knew exactly when to be its filthiest. Sometimes offensive comments, they make you laugh, and that's okay. This movie became instantly quotable, and that's needed more in movies today. We all deserve it, frankly.
I picked up a tail.
Federal?
I don't know. You tell me. That's why I tossed the list. The workups, all of that shit. To protect, in part, your Hermes Fasanabla ass. What do you think I like coming in here? But hey, shit happens. Gotta roll with it. Adapt. Darwin, I Ching.
Number 9, 2004's Collateral. A cab driver finds himself the hostage of an engaging contract killer as he makes his rounds from hit to hit during one night in Los Angeles. The summer of 2004 sees its second release, another I had to hop onto the Metro if I wanted to see. This time it was by myself, weeks before its nationwide release. The streets at night in Los Angeles never seemed so close, so tangible, as they did behind a lens manned by Michael Mann. Tom Cruise, he's never been better. Sorry, Magnolia fans. And it was the best performance of that year by Jamie Foxx, with all due respect to a deserving Oscar-winning performance in Ray. Collateral never let you settle in your seat. Instead, it constantly moved the juxtapositions of its main two characters until an unsettling, yet highly satisfying resolution. And that nightclub scene, if your heart rate wasn't climbing, you weren't paying attention.
You create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream. And they fill it with their subconscious.
How could I ever acquire enough detail to make them think that it's reality?
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something was actually strange.
Number 8, 2010's Inception. A thief who steals corporate secrets through the use of dream-sharing technology is given the inverse task of plotting an idea in the mind of a CEO. Man, it's a great thing when movies live up to the hype. It's also great when they push the boundaries of CGI and technology without sacrificing an unreal script and stellar performances. I can't remember, frankly, a movie which demanded I sit up, nearly perch up in my seat, and stare at the screen in an almost transfixed state, trying to capture so many moments within a single frame, within a few seconds. Forget the mystery embedded so deeply within the story itself. I realized very quickly into this film that this was filmmaking on a level that I really hadn't seen before. And I had to appreciate it for everything it said and everything it didn't.
His brain didn't respond to conditioning, but he wasn't a con man. You know, when she looked into his eyes, she thought he could be the same person. When I looked into his eyes, I thought I saw recognition. Now I know, you fake it. If you think you're supposed to recognize somebody, you just pretend to. You bluff it to get a pat on the head from the doctors. You bluff it to seem less of a freak.
Number 7 comes from the year 2000. Surprise, surprise, it's Memento. A man juggles a search for his wife's murderer, keeping his short-term memory loss from being an obstacle. If movie number 6 on this list would be my top high school recommended viewing, here's one of the top ones from college. It's also my second straight Christopher Nolan flick on this list, but my last. Shocking for some, maybe. As the last third of The Dark Knight, it just lost me. As for Memento, it was built on a premise unlike any other I'd seen in movies before it. It forced me to restart the movie 3 times within its first 30 minutes. Just to make sure I was watching the movie properly and understanding what I was seeing. And immediately after it was over, I immediately went to the next room and sought the opinions and the similar muddled interpretations of friends who had seen it before, which only led to more and more repeat viewings of my own. To this day, Memento still forces my complete attention, and that's not an easy feat in the 21st century.
What are you stopped here for? What's the matter with that space over there?
It's too tight.
Too tight? You could land a jumbo fucking jet in there.
Wait, leave him alone. He's a natural. Hit your Tyrone.
I'm sorry. a natural fucking idiot.
Just on the cusp of the top five, number six, 2000's Snatch. Unscrupulous boxing promoters, violent bookmakers, a Russian gangster, incompetent amateur robbers, and supposedly Jewish jewelers fight to track down a priceless stolen diamond. It's crazy to me how many movies released in the year 2000 are on this list. I was only 17, but perhaps it's when movies, especially with the floodgate of cheap DVDs at this time, first started being recommended to me from friends, whose opinions I had come to trust. Snatch is one of those I scoffed at quite a bit. That is, until I watched it. Snatch is just cool. Ridiculously cool. Its one-of-a-kind cast blends unknowns and megastars, but always comes back to a central theme. It's just a cool movie. It's what Guy Ritchie does. And there's not many deserving of higher praise from a high schooler in the 2000s than just saying it's the coolest movie I remember watching at the time.
This one time, I run by this old lady. I was running, hollering, cutting a fool, boy. This old lady, she stopped me. She said, running around, catching a boy that light. In moonlight, black boys look blue. You blue. That's what I gonna call you. Blue.
Movie number five is the most recent Academy Award winner for Best Picture. More on that story. It's 2016's Moonlight, a chronicle of the childhood, adolescence, and burgeoning adulthood of a young African-American gay man growing up in a rough neighborhood of Miami. I watched Moonlight the Friday before, well, it was really 48 hours before, the most recent Academy Awards. And I hadn't seen La La Land either, to be fair. 20 minutes into Moonlight, I had to stop. I stepped outside of my house, literally walked on my back porch with my then-fiancé and now-wife, and we just talked for 45 minutes straight. In fact, she did a lot of listening. And the majority of that time was spent discussing the earliest years of my life. The movie hit me like a ton of bricks. It shattered me after those first 20 minutes. And the thing is, it was a story completely opposite, a polar difference from my own. And yet it spoke to me, and I'm sure many others, as if it was having a one-on-one conversation. Look, it's even more shocking that I think about this, because when this movie didn't win Best Picture, I turned the TV off. I wasn't mad, just a little disappointed. And after seeing La La Land, I still would have given it to Moonlight. The ironic thing is I didn't know that Moonlight won Best Picture in one of the most controversial moments in Oscar history until the next day at lunch. But it was satisfying, much like the movie was. It's a voice I hadn't heard before, and yet spoke louder than I could imagine.
You don't think I deserve your attention?
I think if your clients want to sit on my shoulders and call themselves tall, they have a right to give it a try. But there's no requirement that I enjoy sitting here listening to people lie. You have part of my attention. You have the minimum amount. The rest of my attention is back at the offices of Facebook, where my colleagues and I are doing things that no one in this room, including and especially your clients, are intellectually or creatively capable of doing.
Just left off the metal podium is number four, The Social Network, released in 2010. Harvard student Mark Zuckerberg creates the social networking site that would become known as Facebook, but is later sued by two brothers who claimed he stole their idea and the co-founder who was later squeezed out of the business. So they're making a movie about Facebook, with Jesse Eisenberg and Justin Timberlake? Who is Armie Hammer, who is Andrew Garfield, and who is Rooney Mara? But wait, the director's David Fincher. Okay, I'm going to give this a shot. And what we ended up, I honestly think is going to ultimately become the definitive movie of this generation, in terms of the voice it speaks to, and what it came to represent, just like The Graduate did decades before. If only this movie hadn't lost to a shrill, one that was built on crocodile tears and Oscar speeches, The King's Speech. Fortunately, though, The Social Network's legacy and every part of it, it's going to remain a major staple of filmmaking in the 21st century and beyond.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked you a question.
873.
873. 873. That's just hot shit. 873.
They're counting today, sir, yes.
That's got to be a record.
Third place in the bronze medal, 2008's The Hurt Locker. During the Iraq War, a sergeant recently assigned to an army bomb squad is put at odds with his squad mates due to his maverick way of handling his work. Back in the day when I wrote for an Oscar blog, yep, I did that. I tried not to ride too hard for certain movies to come home with a big award during Academy Awards season. That was until 2010, which pitted the over-bloated behemoth that was Avatar, also known as Pocahontas with Blue People, and the little indie war drama that could, The Hurt Locker. A movie so calculating, so visceral, that it literally had me sweating in an air-conditioned theater. And that was almost 6 months before this movie hit any sort of mainstream attention, and I drove 60 miles away from my house just to see it. I stood up, pumping my fists, when The Hurt Locker captured both Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow and Best Picture. I will always ride for this movie. And the story behind its monumental rise is just part of its greatness, even once the movie's over.
Can't you for 1 second imagine that none of this had happened? And my drugs had gone through? What would be the harm? Huh? What would be the harm? A few people get high who are getting high anyway. Your partner's still alive. We don't have to have breakfast together. Don't you see this means nothing? Your whole life is pointless.
Number two, the silver medal goes to 2000's Traffic. A conservative judge is appointed by the president to spearhead America's escalating war against drugs, only to discover that his teenage daughter is a crack addict. Two DEA agents protect an informant. A jailed drug baron's wife attempts to carry on the family business. The stories that interweave to make up the fabric of Traffic show exactly why a true ensemble cast can make a legendary film. And the aforementioned tagline, it didn't even discuss its greatest performance, courtesy of an Academy Award-winning performance by Benicio del Toro, as perhaps the last clean and yet still conflicted cop in all of Mexico. This is Steven Soderbergh's top masterpiece, that's right, I said it, even from the 90s, seamlessly blending the way that films could and should be made in this new century, both behind the camera and in front of it. I thought it was my clear-cut number one film of all time. That was until number one came out.
Chovia viciado na Cidade de Deus. E dinheiro no bolso do Zé Pequeno.
Deu pra colar esta maneira?
Valeu.
É, tranquilo. Aí, tô escolhendo um desses relógios aqui pra poder sair mais tarde.
Esse aqui é maneiro. Se o tráfico fosse legal, o pequeno ia ser o homem do ano.
And number one, 2002's City of God. Two boys growing up in a violent neighborhood of Rio de Janeiro take different paths. One becomes a photographer, the other a drug dealer. Simply put, this Brazilian crime drama has more tension, drama, grit, and raw emotion packed into its running time than any superhero, big-budget tentpole release could ever hope for. I watched it for the first time in absolute awe, and I immediately watched it again. Truth be told, I did this 3 times over a 7-day span following that first night's double feature. City of God has changed the way I watch movies forever. Look, it's Michael Jordan on my list, the GOAT, the greatest of all time, and that isn't changing, ever. It's a perfect movie. That simple.
Do you know who I am?
No, I can't say that I do.
I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal.
Really?
People know me.
Well, I'm very happy for you.
I'm very important. I have many leather-bound books, and my apartment smells of rich mahogany.
So I feel like no matter how you tackle it, when you make a top 25 list, especially something as polarizing as this type of a topic, there's going to be 2 to 3, if not more, glaring omissions. And I know I spoke on a few above, but you're going to notice I didn't have any superhero movies anywhere on my list. Which I know fans of the genre, and especially fans of The Dark Knight, maybe the top on many lists, they're not going to be thrilled about that. But you try to sell me on the last third of The Dark Knight, where the movie just slows to a crawl, and that flimsy ending didn't buy it. But there are two movies that I know people are going to start bringing up immediately, and that's There Will Be Blood and Lost in Translation. First off, the latter. Look, I wasn't a fan. Sorry, not sorry. But as for There Will Be Blood, you know, I feel like life doesn't want me to watch this movie at least straight through one time. And it just isn't one of my all-time favorites when I have got the chance to watch it. In fact, I think the story behind me missing it the first 2 times is almost a more memorable experience than most people watching it. The first time I saw it, the fire alarm goes off in the movie theater, it won't stop. We're talking 15 minutes. And a refund was issued. Second time, different theater. My roommate texts me that he's broken down on the shoulder of I-95, he's walletless, and he needs my help immediately. I got like 10 minutes in. Then I rent the DVD, and I kid you not, my DVD player, I didn't know they even did this. It scratches it up, it eats it up, the DVD's busted, and somehow I gotta pay Redbox $30. Makes no sense whatsoever. Look, I have seen it, I enjoyed it, I liked it, but I didn't love it. Look, if I'm being truly honest, the films that really missed my top 25, the ones that I had to look back on, in fact, I watched two of them yesterday, those are movies like Michael Clayton, Before Sunset, In Bruges, Spirited Away, Zodiac, and yes, it just missed The Dark Knight.
Why so serious?
Whether you agreed for the most part with my list, disagreed, had some problems, or you think I'm an idiot, I do hope you enjoyed the listen. And who knows, maybe it sparked your interest to list a few, or even all 25 of your favorite films from the first, let's say fifth, almost, of the 21st century. Thanks for listening, and I can't wait to discuss with many of you, whether in person or on social media, your thoughts. All the information to do that is in the description to this episode, and we hope you do.
Oh, they let you pick any name you want when you get down there.
And you landed on McLovin.
Yeah, I was between that and Muhammad.
Why the fuck would it be between that or Muhammad? Why don't you pick a common name like a normal person?
Muhammad is the most commonly used name on Earth. Read a fucking book for once.
Fogel, have you ever actually met anyone named Muhammad?
Have you actually ever met anyone named McLovin?
As for this podcast, it's like I said last time. We'll be back when we're back. But the Baker's Dozen podcast isn't going anywhere. There's plenty of time this summer and always plenty to discuss. Maybe it'll be NBA Free Agency, the British Open, the anticipated, at least for yours truly, July releases of Game of Thrones and Dunkirk, or whatever tickles my fancy. But you'll only find out if you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. But until then, it's on to the next one.
It says here we should work in teams. Who wants to be my spotter?
I don't think you should be doing too much gambling tonight, Alan.
Gambling? Who said anything about gambling? It's not gambling when you know you're going to win. Counting cards is a foolproof system.
It's also illegal.
It's not illegal. It's frowned upon, like masturbating on an airplane.
I'm pretty sure that's illegal, too.
Yeah, maybe after 9/11, where everybody gets so sensitive. Thanks a lot, Bin Laden.